Can you open with a reading for us?
I'll read from a piece called True Romances, which is from a book called True Stories, which is a book of poetry, but the pieces I'm reading are in fact prose. And this piece I wrote in tribute to my early life. I started writing when I was in high school, and at that time I never thought that I would make any money doing it, so I bought a magazine called Writer's Markets to look up and see what I could make money at to support myself. And it was obvious from reading this magazine that the only real money to be made out of writing was to be made writing for True Confessions magazines. So I thought that I would do that, and I went out and bought some True Confessions magazines, and I read them. And I thought it should be easy enough, because the plots were all very similar. They all had to do with guilt, usually connected with sex. So I concocted a couple of likely-sounding plots and sat down to write them, but I somehow couldn't master the style, which involved a lot of dots. You had to say, for instance, "and then we were one, dot, 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 dot." So with that, I never got further than about the first paragraph. It was my first writing failure. Many years later, however, I wrote a little tribute to that early experience called True Romances, and it has five different kinds of plots in it, all involving men and women, and I'm going to read three of them. A long time ago, I was desperately in love. Desperately is what I mean. In fact, you could leave out the love and still get a good picture. He felt the same way, and the strange thing was, neither of us could understand a word the other said. Because of this, we used to throw dishes at one another, to attract each other's attention, I suppose. We used to shout. For some reason, they were always his dishes. Once I ran into his kitchen and cut a hole in my arm with his kitchen scissors, not a very big hole, so he could see there was real blood inside, but he didn't understand that either. It isn't sex that's the problem, it's language. Or maybe love makes you deaf, not blind, because now we go out to dinner every once in a while and we can understand each other perfectly. We tell jokes and we laugh at them, we really think they're funny. I look at him, and I can't believe we once threw dishes at each other, but we did. I can remember which plates, which cups, which glasses, and which ones broke. My friend called me on the telephone and said, "I'm going to kill myself." "Why?" I said. "He's left me," she said. "I have nothing to live for." "All right," I said. "How are you going to do it? Pills?" "No," she said, "that would make me sick. If it doesn't work, I mean. I can't stand having my stomach pumped out, it's humiliating." "Well, a gun then," I said. "Think of the mess," she said. "It's indelible, and I hate loud noises." "Hanging," I said. "You look so awful," she said. "You could say the same of drowning," I said. "Well, I guess that's that," she said, "but what am I going to do, now that he's left me and I have nothing to live for?" "Who told you it has to be for anything?" I said. "But were you living for him when he was there?" "No," she said. "I was living in spite of him. I was living against him." "Then you should say, 'I have nothing to live against,'" I said. "It's the same thing, isn't it?" she said. I said, "No." "Most people in that country don't eat eggs," she told me. "They can't afford to. If they're lucky enough to have a chicken that lays eggs, they sell the eggs. There is no such thing as inside. There's no such thing as I. The landscape is continuous. It flows through whatever passes for houses there, dried mud in and out, famine in and out. There is only we. That's why they can kill so many of us and not make any difference. To make a difference, they would have to kill all of us. They cut off the hands and heads to prevent identification, but they cannot prevent it. Everyone knows who has been shot and thrown into the sea, who has been beaten, which man or woman has been methodically raped, which left to starve and burn in a pit under the noon sun. It's bright there and clear. You can see a long way. "As for my lover," she told me, "we had to separate. None of us can afford to live with just one other. You get careless. You forget how much you want to live. You start making bargains with yourself. You become dangerous to others. That kind of love is a weapon they can use against you. Among those of us who still have heads and hands, there are no marriages.
Thanks for reading that. When you were reading, before you became known as a writer, did you have as much trouble finding things to read that you felt related to you as you did finding saleable subjects like this romance stuff that they suggested that was marketable?
Let's see. I've always been quite a heavy reader, and I don't think it ever occurred to me to feel that the people in the books that I read had to be like me. Oh, I read every kind of thing you can imagine. We had a lot of books around the house, most of them written before 1900. But I was reading, for instance, Robert Louis Stevenson and Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters with about equal involvement. You know, the characters in Stevenson's books were men, by and large. Those in Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte were women. I would say the distance between myself and them was about equal. There wasn't much in Canada at the time that was written about Canadians, so that left me out right then and there. And contemporary literature I didn't really plug into until I was in college, and I was a heavy reader in high school, but I was reading, quotes, English classics and equally much, you know, comic books and junk science fiction and things like that. I read everything, I still do.
I think a lot of women who have found your novels have really been looking hard for novels by women with a stronger and an interestingly drawn woman character at the center of the novel. Have you intentionally been trying to create novels to fill that gap that many women perceive?
I started writing in 1956, which is a long time before the women's movement in its latest version struck. But of course, we have been living in the women's movement since at least, let's say, 1775, just to put a date on it. It's probably a little early, but certainly in the 19th century, there was a women's movement, several different kinds of women's movements. And it would be very difficult to read much of, for instance, George Eliot, without encountering a lot of the ideas that have now become current. So that, you know, the mere fact that somebody like Jane Austen could read, could write, could publish, could become successful was an indication of a real shift in the position of women, which took place several centuries ago. They had a long way to go, but it was beginning then. So I think that the reading I did in the 19th century was part of that continuum. And I found those women characters interesting, although they were removed in time and space. So when I started writing novels, I simply felt part of a tradition which included interesting women characters. I didn't feel that I was doing something altogether new, nor did I feel that I was, quotes, filling a gap. So that's more or less how I place myself. I wrote The Edible Woman in 1964-5, which was a good 5 years before the women's movement got going.
Do you think of yourself as a feminist writer?
Every woman who can read and write is a feminist by inheritance.
You want to explain that?
Yes. The alternative is the view that women ought not to be permitted to read, write, think, act, do anything but stay in their houses, take care of their families, that kind of activity, or alternatively be prostitutes. And the drive, you know, for female education was part of that earlier feminist movement that I was talking about, and every woman who goes to school is an inheritor of that. It's not so very long that women have been going to school. And there are all shades of conviction within the feminist movement, you know, including women who say, well, I believe that women should have a job, but I'm not a feminist, or I believe that women should have the right to own property, but I'm not a feminist. You know, all the people who make this disclaimer are simply ignorant of history.
Were you aware of that when you were coming of age?
What is one aware of when one comes of age? Not much.
Was there a turning point for you when you
Let's see, when I started consciously thinking about it. I studied the Mill and the Floss when I was in grade 11. Now that is a book in which that issue is right up in the front row. You know, it's about a girl who is very bright and who is denied the right to do anything with that intelligence. And is destroyed by society because of that. And you can't, you know, everybody, well, you could say, well, it was said in the 19th century and things aren't like that now, but you can't read a book at that age without being very impressed by it. So I think that kind of thing was early on my mind. But also remember that the other thing I inherited was that 19th century romantic view that A, artists are doomed, and B, women artists are doomed in special ways. You know, that you have to be Emily Dickinson and live in a closet, or you have to be the Brontes and die young, or you have to be Jane Austen and not get married, or you have to be Christina Rossetti looking at life through the wormholes in a shroud. So there is that feeling that to be a woman artist was risky. To be an artist was risky, but to be a woman artist was risky in a particular way. And I don't think those kinds of views started changing until very recently. I see Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton as the tail end of that tradition in which, you know, to be a female artist was to be somehow doomed, and the appropriate finish to such a life would be suicide.
You don't feel that you're headed on this doomed course
no,
now?
No, not me. Not me. But other people project that image onto you quite strongly. People used to ask me in all seriousness, not whether I was going to kill myself, but when.
Seriously?
Seriously, yes. I've been asked that at readings.
Was
not it? Recently, but in the beginning of the 70s when Sylvia Plath was peaking, you might say, people would ask that, and there was very much a feeling of that whole 19th century post-romantic image of the artist as somebody who must suffer on behalf of society and, you know, suffer more than other people did and be crazier than other people were and that kind of image. Of course, if you go back far enough in literary history, you realize how recent even that is. It is romantic. It's since the French Revolution that those kinds of images became really prevalent.
Do you try to dispel those ideas for your readers?
Yes. I don't feel that the artist is necessarily more doomed, more neurotic, more crazy, more alcoholic, more anything than other people in the society. And my proof is, look who's in the loony bins. You know, they aren't populated wall-to-wall with writers and artists. My own feeling is that creativity is, by its nature, a healthy thing to be doing. You know, the content of it may be distorted by the person's life, but the activity per se is a healthy activity. And given two people of equal unhappiness and neurotic inclinations, one of whom is an artist and one isn't, the artist will be happier.
Margaret Atwood is my guest, novelist and poet. Were you ever active in the feminist movement, you know, as a movement in either in any demonstrations or consciousness-raising groups or in radical politics at all?
I lend my name a lot and I appear at functions a lot, and I feel that that is probably the best use for me. I'm not much good at backroom politics. I don't like meetings. I don't feel it's a really good thing for me to be using my time for. I would rather use my time. I'd rather put my thumb in the hole in the dike that it fits, you know.
Well, how do you find out what you're appropriate for in something like that?
Well, remember, I'm 43 years old. I've had a while to think about it. And I might add also that any woman coming of age in the 50s and being a writer and continuing to write through the early 60s, in fact, through just about all of the 60s, had to do a bit of consciousness raising of her own before there were a lot of people around to cheer her on. You know, the people I grew up with were talking about washing machines and collecting their dishes. They weren't talking about being successful at things.
Were you excited to find that there was a movement?
I was
that
glad
was
to see him. Where have you been all my life, said I, at the age of 30. I was glad to see them. On the other hand, there are pitfalls, as there are with everything. You know, people try to then make you a spokesperson for what they want to be saying and what they want to be thinking.
Has that happened to you?
Oh, sure. I mean, it happens to everybody, to a certain extent. But what you have to do is simply do what you were doing before, which is to maintain the integrity of what you have to say and not let yourself be distorted by other people. But that's easy enough to do.
You know, sometimes radical movements will ask you to, like, lend your name or do mm-hmm. an appearance or something, and because it's a righteous cause, we'll expect that you can do it for free and find the time.
Sometimes
and
I do that, but don't publicize that.
Do you ever
I guess
feel,
we just have.
Do you ever feel guilty when you say no to something, though?
I have to say no so much that I've gotten over the guilt. You know, I pick the ones that I feel are really important for me to do. I'm here in this city partly because a real pitch was made to the man who arranges my readings on behalf of a women's organization. I didn't want to do three readings in a row, but I tacked this one on the end because of that, not doing it for free, but things like amnesty I do, and nuclear disarmament I feel is a biggie these days.
Many of the characters in... Well, let me stop a second. Jay, I hear a kind of rumbling occasionally.
It's the CIA.
The CIA. Oh, I see what it is. Okay. Yeah, I think if your leg was hitting the table...
I don't think it was.
Okay, because that... Everything makes noise.
Okay, maybe it was my arms.
Okay. I'll just edit that out, so don't worry about it. I mean, I'll just edit out this little interlude here. Okay. Can you just paper cue that, Jay? Many of the characters in your fiction are either finding an identity for themselves or reshaping the identity that they think they have. This seems to be a real central concern in your fiction. Can you talk about why?
Well, there again, I think it's very hard to write about a central character who is a woman without having that happen to a certain extent. Or, to put it another way around, you can divide plots into two kinds, one in which the conflict or the crisis arrives from outside, which gives you most genre fiction, you know, most detective stories, most adventure stories, a lot of science fiction, and so on. The other kind of plot is the one in which the crisis is internal. Let us say the Henry Jamesian model, in which the climax of the story is a realization on the part of the character that either their perceptions have been wrong or their view of themselves has been wrong. Things change. So when you're writing a novel which is not a murder mystery, not an adventure story, not a that kind of fiction, the character changes. Unless you want to end up with either a very experimental book like Andy Warhol's movie on sleeping, which somebody slept for 25 hours. You know, you can do a kind of Pinteresque thing or a Beckett thing in which nothing changes. You know, you just get the same model repeated over and over again, or you're back at the beginning when you're at the end. But if you aren't doing that, then you're showing some kind of development, either in a relationship or within a person or both. Now, the kind of novel I wrote in Bodily Harm is one in which the crisis is both external and internal, that what happens changes the person and, to a certain extent, vice versa. But the novel before that, Life Before Man, I deliberately sat in 1 square mile of a city. Nobody goes out, nobody comes in. It's a claustrophobic situation, so that the change is all internal, the change is within the characters.
In Bodily Harm, the woman who's at the center of the novel has breast cancer, and at one point she's having a conversation with another character in the novel, a man, about whether cancer is a symbolic thing or whether it's just a disease and mm-hmm. isn't a symbolic manifestation of things, psychological things or whatever happening within you. What do you think of that question yourself? How much do you think of illness as being an expression of emotional problems?
I think some illnesses are and some aren't. You know, it's as simple as that. I think the difficulty with that view is that people sometimes use it as an excuse to blame the person who has the disease, you know, that it's your fault because you, you know, fill in the blank, didn't express anger enough, aren't this enough, aren't that enough. And that can merely end up making the person feel even worse than they already feel. So there is that pitfall. On the other hand, you can say, okay, once having got the disease, whatever it is, it is provably true that those with a more happy and optimistic outlook about it tend to get better more than those who think they're doomed and are going to die. Your state of mind, in fact, can influence your body to that extent. So if one can avoid, you know, blaming the victim, which does get done a lot in other ways too in our society, I think you can say that there is some mind-body connection. I wouldn't go so far as the person who told me that I ought to be able to dissolve my wisdom teeth by meditating on them, however.
Who told you that?
Somebody who believed that mind-body connection was absolute, you know, total absolute, no exceptions.
What kind of research did you do to create this woman who has breast cancer and is also a lifestyle typewriter?
Yeah, the lifestyle journalism research wasn't hard to do at all. All you have to do is pick up a few magazines. You know, that's the beginning. Also, I have done journalism. I have worked with editors, so that was right there for me. And also, I knew several, so that I, in fact, ran the manuscript past one, and she said the part she thought was the most dead-on for her was when the woman is coming back in the plane and the man tries to pick her up, and she immediately says, you know, I'm a journalist, because she doesn't want to be mistaken for a secretary. She said that's very accurate. And the other things, too, were fun to do. But the cancer part was a lot less fun. As everybody does these days, I know and have known people with it of various kinds. So I'm afraid I didn't have to do a lot of actual research on that. It was, the material was there. I did some medical research, but the attitudes and reactions and so on are plain to be seen. But of course, one of the things that writers do is they use their imaginations. They put themselves in the position of the person in that situation and take it from there. You don't have to be told a lot of those things by other people. You don't have to go around and ask a lot of questions. You can do it yourself.
Did you, like your character, does travel to the Caribbean?
I've been traveling there since about 1972. I have friends there. I originally went down because I had friends there. I went to visit them. The political situation described is pretty accurately based on fact, and I had access to that fact because I knew people.
So that's why you chose the Caribbean?
Yeah.
The book we're referring to now, by the way, is a recent novel called Bodily Harm, and my guest is novelist and poet Margaret Atwood. Your latest book is a collection of short stories called Dancing Girls, and in several of those stories, again, the quest for identity or for changing identity or understanding one's identity is an important part of many of the stories. In one of the stories, an older woman is reflecting on the time when she was younger, and there was a couple who she knew where the man seemed very mysterious and very exciting to her as a child, and his wife seemed kind of plain and unimportant. And she thought of herself as plain and unmysterious, too. Where does that come from?
That feeling that plain, unmysterious people are really mysterious. I think probably from having known and met a lot of people who at first seemed to be plain and unmysterious and then hit you over the head from behind with something totally unexpected. But I'm sure that's a very familiar happening in the lives of many people. I think we tend to make snap judgments about people. We judge them on external appearance and social manner. And anyone with a conventional external appearance in an ordinary social manner, we think, is probably unmysterious. It's usually quite wrong.
Did you feel plain and unmysterious
Me?
When you were young?
I don't think... I don't think of myself a lot in those terms. You know, I don't categorize or define myself as this or that. I refer you to Keats, who talked a lot about the chameleon poet and the ability of the writer to change shapes. And I think that if you try to define yourself too closely as one thing or another, if you're a writer, you can get very stuck in a rut.
We were talking a little before about the lifestyle journalist who you have in Bodily Harm. Have you been interviewed by people like that?
I've been interviewed by people like that lots.
How do you handle it?
Same way as I'm handling this. I mean, if people ask me a straightforward, honest question, I'll try to give a straightforward, honest answer. The lifestyle journalists are interested in things like how do you plan your wardrobe for doing a book promotion tour, but I can answer that. You know, it's a simple enough. And it's stupid to pretend that writers don't think about those things. They do. They think about them just as much as everybody else thinks about them.
In your book, Lady Oracle, the main character writes gothic romances. How did you get yourself into the appropriate mindset for that? Have you...
Well, there again, of course, one of my favorite books when I was starting to read was Wuthering Heights. And gothic romances, as we have them today, are basically a degenerate form, which has devolved from Wuthering Heights crossed with Jane Eyre. So that was the primary source. You know, all gothic romances have those elements in them. Harlequin romances, which are a different thing, devolve from Pride and Prejudice rather than Wuthering Heights. Pride and Prejudice is essentially the Cinderella story. It's how you meet Prince Charming, who ignores you at first because he doesn't know you're Sterling Worth. But then throughout the book, he comes to realize that you are, in fact, Elizabeth Bennet, and he is Mr. Darcy, and you get a proposal at the end. That's the Harlequin romance. The Jane Eyre Wuthering Heights model is much more like Why Is My Husband Trying to Kill Me? And it's the one with the mad wife and the orphan, the two women. And the two men are the bad man who appears to be good and the good man who appears to be bad. And if you want the names in the original novels, Mr. Rochester is the good man who appears to be bad, and so is Heathcliff. And Linton is the bad man who appears to be good. And there's even one in Jane Eyre. It's the preacher who wants Jane Eyre to marry him and go to Africa. And she says that she knows that it would kill her to do that. So it's all there in the Brontes, and people have just been copying it ever since. How did I get into it? I think I've always been interested in the point of collision between real life as we live it, you know, with the kitchen sink and the shoes that don't fit and you know, the pimple on your neck that you would rather wasn't there, and the romantic versions of them. And when we fantasize, when we daydream, we tend much more to fantasize in the romantic mode than in the realistic mode. You know, when you are fantasizing, it's usually through a gauze screen. I mean, things that you actually encounter in real life are left out. You're always graceful even during the death scenes. So I'm interested at that point, you know, the point where reality collides with fantasy.
What appeals to you about that the form that the Brontes?
Oh, those
created?
Are very powerful books. They are, among other things, one of the two of the first books with female characters in them who stepped beyond the bounds of convention as set by society. The Jane Austen model was the smart woman, you know, the woman with her wits about her, has sense rather than sensibility. You know, she doesn't go streaming over the hills in rainstorms. She doesn't fall madly in love with inappropriate people. Whereas the Brontes were taking Byron, really, and turning him inside out, making the women the Byronic figures, if you like.
Have you read any of the modern romances that are popular now?
Oh, yeah, I went through a batch of them when I was writing Lady Oracle, but that was in the 70s and was published in 76, and they have since that time become more explicitly sexual, I would say, and more explicitly sexually sadistic than they used to be.
Where do you think that's happening?
Oh, literary forms and conventions change according to what gets used up. Now, it hasn't happened in certain set forms. They tried to, for instance, make Harlequin romances sexier, and the audience protested. The audience did not want them that way. They wanted the mold kept the way it was. But there's another audience which prefers Gothics to Harlequins, and Gothics have always been much more inherently sadistic. The other model for them, of course, is Mrs. Radcliffe, in which orphans were always being chased around ruined castles by uncles with malevolent intentions. And in Mrs. Radcliffe, nobody ever actually got raped. And in the modern Gothics, they don't usually. They usually just escape by a hair's breadth, but there's always that threat.
Would you read those books for pleasure or research?
Research. I'm so familiar with the form that it can't surprise me very much. And unless they're very well done, which a few of them are, but usually they aren't, they annoy me because the details are wrong. As the writer in Lady Oracle says, they get the costumes wrong. I am a Victorianist, you know. I know when crinolines came in and when they went out and when there were bustles and when there weren't. And they usually get the social manners and the mannerisms wrong as well. It's really just like, you know, little kids playing dress-ups. It's not of great interest.
Have you studied that for your fiction? Or for
the costumes? Reasons? Of course. There's a wonderful book called History of Costume by Amelia Davenport, which is of great interest to anybody interested in the subject, because it has from Roman times up into about 1900, a little after 1900, in great detail, when snuff boxes came in, varieties of snuff box, the origin, evolution, and development of the wig, the history of canes. Fascinating things.
I think that stuff must tell you a lot about the...
It tells you a lot about the social customs and attitudes of the time, how it was considered appropriate to dress, at what social level, the importance that appearance had for people, the kinds of snobberies and things associated with dress, and also what was considered loose or fast or the mark of a prostitute and what was considered the mark of a respectable woman. It's very, very interesting stuff.
What do you think you could learn by looking at women's clothes now?
Now there's a great variety. Comparing it with even up until about 1965, I would say, a look would come in, you know, a fashion would come in, and then that was how you had to look, or else you were out of style, out of date. And now I think although things come in and you see a batch of it around, there's a great deal more latitude about how people feel they can dress and present themselves. And that, to me, would argue a much greater feeling of individuality, that you do not have to put yourself into a presentable kind of mold. You don't have to look a certain way, just one certain way, that you have a choice. And I think people are improvising a lot. I think they're making up their own costumes more, even more than in the early days of feminism, when there was a kind of uniform that you couldn't paint up your face, you couldn't, you know, you had to just do certain things. You had to wear combat uniforms.
Do you see your own clothes as being symbolic, since you've paid such attention to studying the history of clothes?
I have a certain range of colors that I wear. I don't wear any other colors. I have certain shapes that I prefer. I don't wear other shapes. Mostly I dress for comfort. I don't like tight clothing because I can't breathe in it. I don't feel comfortable in it. It's symbolic in that way. The colors are colors that I like. And I think it's now possible for people to do that and do it quite comfortably without feeling eccentric.
Margaret Atwood is my guest novelist and poet. You're from Canada, grew up there and still live there. Is there a strong Canadian literary scene?
There is now. This, again, is very recent. I date it from about 1965. And the first years, I would say it consisted mostly of poetry. The novel didn't come in as a widely read form in Canada by Canadian authors until about 1969-70. So now there is, but the generation before mine, a lot of people felt they had to leave the country because they didn't feel there was an audience, they didn't feel there was a community that they could live in and function in, and it was a very puritanical country. Some things you just couldn't publish there, and now it's very lively, and it's a good place to be as a writer.
Are you heralded by your fellow Canadians since you've become such a well-known writer?
Well, my fellow Canadians have taken just about every attitude towards me that it's possible to take. I mean, including the Second Coming and the Antichrist. I mean, there's a great range. I'm widely read. I think I've probably stepped over the line that separates writers from public figures. I'm one of those people who gets called up and asked what I think of the latest development and politics and things like that. So, yes, I would have to say that my fellow Canadians have really been, on the whole, pretty good to me, although there's a few of them I'd like to grind up into small pieces.
Do you ever have the temptation to separate yourself from the events of the day and from being a public person so as to not... Some writers are just so sensitive about their... About being penetrated by the outside world or something. They're afraid it'll either upset their equilibrium or just, you know, knock them off balance in some way that will hurt their writing.
When you're working on a book, you tend to be living in a kind of bubble. And not a lot gets in except things having to do with that book. And everything having to do with that book gets in. Everywhere you look, there's something that's relevant, but the other stuff gets shut out. I'm one of those people who feels that distinctions of certain kinds should not be made for artists. In other words, if an artist commits murder and an ordinary citizen commits murder, we aren't allowed to excuse the artist because he was just being artistic, you know? So I think that the kinds of things I'm involved with as a citizen, I would be involved with as a citizen even if I weren't a writer. And I don't think that there's anything about being a writer that excuses you necessarily from those kinds of things.
What are some examples of ways you think that we tend to make excuses for artists?
Oh, I think we, particularly in their personal relationships, you know, I think that sometimes for people with this post-traumatic view of the writer, excuses get made for them that we wouldn't necessarily make for other people.
What are some of the recent books you've read that you've enjoyed?
Okay, I'm going to mention two writers because they aren't ones that you, they aren't ones that are right up on billboards everywhere. One of them is a young American woman poet called Linda Gregg, G-R-E-G-G. She's only published one book. It's called Too Bright to See. And one of them is a novel by a South African writer called Coetzee, C-O-A-T-Z-E-E. Which could not find a hardback publisher in this country. It was brought out, I think, finally by Penguin. And it's quite an amazing, very well-done novel Waiting for the Barbarians.
Could you read another selection from your writing for us?
Okay, I'm going to read... I'll start again. I'm going to read a piece called Instructions for the Third Eye, which is from a book called Murder in the Dark, which just came out in Canada. It's a collection of very short fiction and, I suppose, what might be called experimental pieces or prose poems. In other words, it's not a book that fits comfortably into any publishing category. And it's only remotely available in the United States. You can get it from the Inland Book Company in Connecticut, or you could get it directly from the publisher, which is Coach House Press in Toronto. This piece is called Instructions for the Third Eye. The eye is the organ of vision, and the third eye is no exception to that. Open it and it sees, close it and it doesn't. Most people have a third eye, but they don't trust it. That wasn't really F, standing on the corner, hands in his overcoat pockets, waiting for the light to change. F died 2 months ago. It's a trick my eyes played on me, they say, a trick of the light. I've got nothing against telepathy, said Jane, but the telephone is so much more dependable. What's the difference between vision and A-vision? The former relates to something it's assumed you've seen, the latter to something it's assumed you haven't. Language is not always dependable either. If you want to use the third eye, you must close the other two, then breathe evenly, then wait. This sometimes works. On the other hand, sometimes you merely go to sleep. That sometimes works also. When you've had enough practice, you don't have to bother with these preliminary steps. You find, too, that what you see depends partly on what you want to look at and partly on how. As I said, the third eye is only an eye. There are some who resent the third eye. They would have it removed if they could. They feel it is a parasite squatting in the center of the forehead, feeding on the brain. To them, the third eye shows only the worst scenery. The gassed and scorched corpses at the cave mouth, the gutted babies, the spoor left by generals, and closer to home, the hearts gone bubonic with jealousy and greed, glinting through the vests and sweaters of anyone at all. Torment, they say and see. The third eye can be merciless, especially when wounded. But someone has to see these things. They exist. Try not to resist the third eye. It knows what it's doing. Leave it alone, and it will show you that this truth is not the only truth. One day you will wake up, and everything, the stones by the driveway, the brick houses, each brick, each leaf of each tree, your own body, will be glowing from within, lit up, so bright you can hardly look. You will reach out in any direction, and you will touch the light itself. After that, there are no more instructions, because there is no more choice. You see. You see.
Thanks for reading that, and thanks a lot for talking with us.
You're welcome.